This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm news director Sarah Bohannon. Today we're diving into some science behind the ways to both track and to predict the spread of COVID-19. We'll be looking into antibody testing, its reliability and limitations, and we'll look at modeling. Why are there so many different models out there, and why they've been predicting different outcomes during this pandemic? As always, if you have a story idea or questions, give us a call on our message line 433-9216 or visit our website, mynspr.org. For Monday, May 11th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Now, some news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. Coronavirus cases and deaths keep rising in California. However, the number and rate of deaths has slowed. Though more than 1,000 new cases were diagnosed in a single day, according to statistics released Monday, the total is growing at a slower pace. Cases were up just under 2% from a day earlier and up 24% compared to a week ago. A total of 67,939 Californians have been afflicted by COVID-19, according to the California Department of Public Health. Fatalities reached 2,770 Monday. Authorities attributed 25 new deaths in the state to the virus Monday, the lowest number in weeks. Deaths are up about 1% compared to a day earlier and 22% compared to a week ago. In the North State, cases continue inching up while deaths have remained static. The virus is also spreading into new areas. Authorities diagnosed one person with coronavirus in Trinity County, leaving Lassen, the sole jurisdiction in the 11-county region, without a case. Sutter County, where officials began lifting restrictions, is reporting 34 cases, including a new case identified Monday. In Shasta County, 31 cases have been identified. In Yuba County, 21. In Butte County, 20. And Glenn County, 6. Siskiyou County found 5 cases, Plumas 4, Colusa 3, Tehama, and Trinity 1. In his press conference Monday, Governor Gavin Newsom said authorities are allowing counties some flexibility with reopening, but warned that the virus's seriousness requires limits.
This is a health-driven conversation. It's not because we don't want to. It's not because we would not like to. It's not because we want to be particularly oppressive in terms of people's desires and needs. It's because public health dictates that we do this in a judicial way. We're not going to deviate from that path.
After last week's reopening of the Yuba Sutter Mall, the North State saw another massive gathering after approximately 2,000 people attended a rodeo in Cottonwood over the weekend. Shasta County health authorities are recommending that anyone who attended seek a test for infection. Carrie Schutte, spokeswoman for the Shasta County Health and Human Services Department, called the event a violation of the state's stay-at-home order. She said enforcement of the order was up to the sheriff's office, which opted to allow the event to proceed. An organizer said few in attendance wore masks. Schutte said, quote, "We are reopening the county in a phased approach aimed at protecting older adults and other vulnerable groups." She continued, "If that's to be a success, it's critical that people follow the guidelines." Close quote. The Cottonwood Rodeo dropped its affiliation with the California Cowboys Pro Rodeo Association this year. The association had canceled 7 past and upcoming events, including ones in Angels Camp, Laytonville, and Garberville. The next scheduled rodeo isn't until the end of June in Duncan's Mills. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. A lack of adequate testing for the novel coronavirus has raised questions about the true number of people who have been infected with COVID-19. Now, with antibody testing underway in the nation and locally, questions are starting to arise about whether this type of testing is accurate and what it can actually tell us. To learn more, NSPR's Andre Bayek recently spoke with Dr. Gigi Quick-Granvall, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Dr. Granvall is the lead author of Developing a National Strategy for Serology in the United States, a report that was published on April 22nd. Andre first asked Dr. Granvall to explain the difference between serological and molecular, or viral, coronavirus testing.
So a molecular test is looking for the presence of the virus. So we're They're used to diagnose active infections. So it's looking for the genetic material of the virus. And but once you clear the virus material, once you get better, then it's helpful to have an antibody test, which can look for a history of infection, because your body makes antibodies in response to the virus, and so you can detect those using these tests.
As to antibody tests specifically, what are the benefits of such tests?
Well, for public health, there's quite a few benefits right now. If you're going to do a survey of people to find out how many people have been exposed to COVID-19 in the past, you get a better sense of what the mortality rate is. You get a sense of whether controls that are put in place are working. You get a sense of what you should be, populations that you should be protecting more if there's a particular vulnerable populations that have not yet had a history of infection. So that's the value for public health. For individuals, the value has been a little bit more mixed because the testing quality has not been as high as it should be. But more and better tests are coming onto the market. And so hopefully they will be a little bit more valuable for people to learn if they had COVID-19 or if they knew they were really sick, but they didn't get tested at the time. And now they find out that, you know, it was that disease.
You mentioned reliability. There are questions regarding the current reliability of antibody tests. In that vein, what are some of the limitations that you've found?
Well, the biggest limitation to antibody tests right now is what they mean. For public health, it's clear what it means. You can find out how much of your population has been exposed, and that has a certain value. But for individuals, it's just not as clear as it should be. More and more evidence is demonstrating that if you've had COVID-19, you have some level of immunity for some period of time. But we don't yet know what antibody levels correlate with that immunity, how long immunity will last, and if there's anything else that might confound your immune response, if it makes a difference, if you are asymptomatic or symptomatic. So there's a lot of data that we just don't have yet. There's so many active investigations into figuring out the science behind COVID-19. But it's just a lot of unknowns right now, what an antibody test really means for an individual.
Speaking to that exact point that you bring up, you know, your report notes that there are significant gaps in the scientific community's understanding of COVID-19 and immunity. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on what those gaps may be at this point?
The biggest gap is just knowing what past exposure means. We need to figure out if antibodies are the way that you clear the virus from your body, and if there's a particular kind of antibody that we can test for that is indicative of that. That'll be helpful just for developing better tests and also to develop potential therapeutics. There's a lot that we don't understand as far as the durability of immunity. How long do those antibodies stick around? And is there a level at which they will, a titer that they will go below that all of a sudden you're not protected anymore? These things, that's another big area where we're going to have to get a lot more information.
Your team also examined three main types of antibody tests for COVID-19, ranging in time to yield a result from around 15 minutes to perhaps several days. At this point, is there any one test that's more reliable than another, or one that's more recommended than another test?
So tests can range in different kinds of accuracy levels. And so in general, the tests that are more rapid are not quite as sensitive as the tests that require laboratory involvement. You know, right now there's the short tests, then there's the ones that require, that give you more information. The ones that that take a few hours, the ELISA tests, they also give you more information about the level of antibodies that you have. It's not just a yes-no. It's a titer that gives you. So if we find out that a certain titer of antibodies is important, those kinds of tests will be more important to figure out if you have the right titer.
I'm hoping you could expand upon accuracy and error rates that you found regarding antibody tests. You know, here in our region, there's been drive-through antibody testing, which you can get a result in about 15 minutes. I'm wondering how people should interpret those results at this point.
Yeah, so I think in response to there was a lot of clamoring for tests to test for the actual presence of the virus, and they weren't available, and so I think the FDA, in reaction to that, took the opposite approach: open the floodgates and let 1,000 flowers bloom, and we have get as many tests as you want. So manufacturers flooded the market, and there were maybe 150 or more types of tests that were available for commercial sale. And some of them were not as accurate as they claimed to be, and none of them were independently validated. And so now we're starting to see some validation studies come out, and it's become clear that not all the tests were appropriately labeled. And so some of the tests were 30% accurate, and you'd like to see something much higher than that. And so the FDA came out with a new rule just a couple days ago to basically tell the manufacturers it has to be of a high specificity and sensitivity so that it can accurately determine whether something is a real positive or a false positive, and be sensitive and capture all the antibodies in the test, and they have 10 days to do that or they have to leave the market. So expecting that the market will tighten up and there'll be much better quality tests available in the next 2 weeks.
Going forward in your report, you explore this sort of fascinating conversation among certain countries, exploring so-called immunity certificates. The idea being an individual who may have a positive serology test could go back to work and re-enter society possibly. But you raise some caution flags. It sounds like there's some uncertainty surrounding that concept.
So when the original idea, people said, oh, well, if we get an antibody test, then you know that you had been infected and you're immune, and it's like a get out of jail free card. You can just go back into society. And why don't we create a system where you can, tell people that you are immune with an immunity passport, and you're released from physical distancing. It sounds good, but it just is not as good when you look into the details. The first thing is that we don't have enough confidence in what the tests really mean yet. So to know how long you're immune for, or if you're immune at all. Although we presume that people who have had the disease have a level of immunity. But is that true for all infections, even the asymptomatic ones? We're just not sure. So there's that uncertainty. And then second, you're creating a system here where if you're only allowing the people who have immunity to go back to work and not doing anything else, none of the other public health measures that could be applied, then you're creating some perverse incentives and making it so that people will want to get sick so that they can participate in these activities. And that's dangerous. It's not just dangerous for the person who makes that decision, but it's potentially dangerous for everyone around them and that they come into contact with. So it just can't be the sole thing that people need to go back to work. There have to be other measures taken, like contact tracing and mask wearing and physical distancing and teleworking. And there are a lot of other things that could be done to try and limit the exposure and to limit transmission besides this one antibody test.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about your report or anything about testing and the coronavirus that you'd like to expand upon or perhaps clarify?
Well, something that's really come up a lot that you might want to highlight is a lot of people are saying we just need to power through and get to a state of herd immunity. And herd immunity is really something that you refer to when you're talking about vaccines. when you can vaccinate a whole population, but then there's some portion of the population who either can't get vaccinated, maybe they're babies and they're not old enough to get vaccinated, or they're older and they don't take to the vaccine, they don't, you know, respond to the vaccine as well. And you rely on the herd of immune people to limit the possibilities of one infected person bumping into another not vulnerable person. And, you know, for a disease like SARS-CoV-2, you're probably going to need like 65-75% immunity before you can get herd immunity. And that's a lot more cases than we have right now. Right now, even if the highest estimates of seroprevalence is well below 20%. So it's just not a good concept when thinking about a disease that causes so much illness and morbidity.
When people talk about herd immunity in that way, herd immunity before a vaccine, are we basically looking at millions of deaths?
Yes, absolutely. That is what we would be looking at. Because, you know, you just have to, there has to be more than one thing done. You're never going to totally eliminate risk, but, you know, you can't just give up all control measures and say, well, we're just not going to do anything about the virus. We should be doing a lot more contact tracing and to find cases and make sure that they don't infect other people. I mean, it's a hard problem. It's definitely hard, but it's not impossible.
That was Dr. Gigi Quick-Granvall, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. You can find a link to that report that Granvall was the lead author of, called Developing a National Strategy for Serology in the United States, on our website, mynspr.org. This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned. You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. By now, you likely know that novel in novel coronavirus means new. And new, especially with deadly diseases, is not good. It means there's no body of work from which scientists and doctors can draw from to understand what this virus does or how quickly. Since the outbreak, researchers have been charting its course and trying to predict its future. Recently, Barbara Fader-Ostrov, a contributing writer at the nonprofit publication CalMatters, published a piece about the powers and limitations of computer models built to track the pandemic and how they inform policymakers. NSPR's Mark Albert recently spoke with Fader-Ostrov, starting the conversation by asking why there is so much variability between the models.
Mostly because they have different assumptions going into them. California officials are using a model developed at Johns Hopkins University, and it assumes that we started social distancing on March 20th, for example. Other states did different shelter-at-home orders. It has an infectious period of up to 6 days. It has what we call an R-naught number, which is how many people one person can infect if you don't do anything to, you know, prevent infection. And that was between 2 and 3 people. It assumes certain fatality rates. It assumes certain level of hospitalized patients, et cetera. Basically, they put in numbers estimating the infectiousness of the virus as they know it at the time. Now, over time, our models evolve and our inputs to the models evolve. And that is why you see different results for different models.
In looking at a story that was published in the New York Times Upshot column on April 22nd, there's a graph of predictions. And interestingly, the one that tracked closest to reality now, at least in terms of deaths across the U.S., is the Johns Hopkins model, the one being used by California. Why are the others off?
Epidemiologists and people who do statistical disease modeling for a living have been arguing about this nonstop pretty much since the pandemic started. And they argue about statistical approaches. They talk about things like fitting data to the curve, which is a hard concept to understand, but basically involves trying to make assumptions from past data and extend it forward, and how useful and credible it is to do that. So that's why we're seeing, again, the different results from the different models.
The president has touted figures from the University of Washington's IHME model, which has predicted 60,000 deaths in the U.S. Perhaps that was done to calm people at the outset who were panicking, or maybe to reduce fear among Wall Street investors, but it was also the lowest among the models. The IHME model is based on extrapolating how the virus moved through other countries where the virus struck first and try to figure out how it would behave here in the U.S. It seems logical. Why would it be inaccurate?
There were different social distancing approaches. For example, in China, they locked down Wuhan, right? And they were able to do a lot more in terms of mandating what people could do than you might find in another country. Other cities around the world have different transportation. Other cities have much different density. So basically, some of the debate has centered around how useful it was to base a model on past data. Now, some of the different models, including the Johns Hopkins models, use kind of a pure theoretical approach. They estimate how contagious the virus will be, that R-naught number, how many people one person can infect without social distancing, how many people might die. These models extrapolate what will happen mathematically, and they have tended to be more accurate rather than models that try to use past disease evolution data in Europe and elsewhere around the world to model what will happen in the future in the United States.
When health leaders are looking at these models and political leaders follow up on them and they look down the line and see projections a month ahead and they're seeing numbers declining, but those models predicting declining numbers in the future, those are based on assuming people stay home, not lifting restrictions and everything getting back to business, right?
Right. And that's why many people are concerned about reopening states too fast. And again, there's a lot of arguing on social media and, you know, in closed rooms of policymakers trying to figure out what to do. I think it's important to remember that disease models, for the most part, are helpful in logistics planning. It's because we had these models projecting that our hospitals and ICUs would be overwhelmed, that we wouldn't have enough ventilators or personal protective equipment like N95 masks, that hospital workers might fall ill in such numbers that they couldn't help take care of other infected people. That is what those models were designed to predict and to plan for. We are now, for better or for worse, looking to these models to say, okay, what do we do now? How should we proceed? And it can be difficult to put all of that on one statistical model that was originally designed just to say, okay, here's what happens if you don't flatten the curve, if you don't reduce the number of cases. You want to avoid having your healthcare system overwhelmed. So we built field hospitals. We got the hospital ships from the U.S. military to come to California, and we prepared extra capacity. Now, it appears that our social distancing and other preventive measures have worked to flatten the curve, and our hospitals, with some exceptions in certain areas like LA, have not been overwhelmed completely like they were in New York, Italy, Spain. And that's a good thing, but it also shows the limits of the models in determining what we can do going forward.
When the cases don't pan out or when the doomsday scenario doesn't appear, it certainly seems to be inspiring a lot of talk about this not being a real event or being a created event or that there's some giant conspiracy attempting to use this virus for some other ends.
Right. I mean, trolls are going to troll, right? The fact that the model's predictions didn't come true is a good thing. It's not an indicator that they were a hoax or that everything was made up. It means that these predictions didn't pan out because we did what we were supposed to do, which is use tried and true public health interventions like social distancing to limit the number of infections. And it's unfortunate that people are now fixating on the models and saying, oh, this is all a hoax or the models are bad, because they were just predicting what could happen, not what would happen. And that's important to remember. They were saying, if X, then Y. You know, you always want public health interventions to be invisible. If everybody does what they're supposed to do, you don't see the bad impacts of what would happen if we didn't. So it looks like there was never a problem to begin with. We basically just prevented a worse problem. Models tend to be better for predicting short-term outcomes and short-term needs. They tend to be more useful to project what we'll need in terms of hospital capacity and protective equipment in the near term rather than the long term. And everybody wants the models to say, will schools open up in September? What will our winter look like if we have flu season on top of another COVID season? And they're not as good at doing that.
That was Barbara Fader-Ostrove, a contributing writer at the nonprofit publication CalMatters. We'll have a link to her story on the powers and limitations of computer models built to track the pandemic on our website, mynspr.org. You can also find it at calmatters.org. And that is your program. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30, or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to NSPR.